from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in March 2003 when FIFA announced that the World Cup soccer tournament would be held in South America for the first time since 1978. Brazil won the hosting rights, setting off many celebrations, but perhaps some also a little bit of concern about money, potential corruption. We're going to get into all of that. Tomorrow, the World Cup kicks off when the hosts open play, and the United States open group play Monday against Ghana. And our American lads are in the so-called group of death. We will explain what that is. Coming up, this hour we delve into Brazilian culture with a couple of University of Rochester professors, a husband and wife team who will be teaching the coolest class in the entire world this fall called History of Latin America Through Soccer. Pablo Sierra is an assistant professor of history at the University of Rochester, an expert on colonial Latin America and the experiences of Africans and their descendants in New Spain. Pablo, nice to see you here.
Thank you for having me.
Molly Ball is here. She is an adjunct professor of history at the University of Rochester, an expert on modern Brazil, an economic historian. And Molly was in Brazil at least during parts of the last two World Cups?
Yeah, so it was kind of my indoctrination to the World Cup experience.
All right. I can't wait to talk about that. And also joining us is Pat Ercole, the team president of the Rochester Rhinos, who will at least guide us in our expectations on the pitch over the coming several weeks. This is always fun for me, Pat. But how is it for you in the soccer world watching this unfold?
Well, it's great. Obviously, I grew up watching it. I started when I was 10 years old in 1970, Brazil and Italy in the final in Mexico. So from that stage on, I had the bug. So, you know, obviously this is a very exciting time for anybody that loves soccer.
But, Pat, you and I, as far as I know, didn't have a chance to take a college course called History of Latin America Through Soccer. I mean, is that the best idea you've ever heard?
I think I wanted to enroll, so I'm trying to find out if I can at least maybe do a lecture or something.
I know. Pablo, you were saying that enrollment so far for the fall course is
pretty strong. We're doing well. We might reach 30, 35 students, which is large for us.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the idea is to take advantage of this natural interest that's brewing because of the World Cup and try to contextualize it.
It's a fabulous idea. Whose idea was it?
This has been a joint idea we've been working on for about 3 or 4, maybe 5 years.
Okay.
We thought that 20th century Latin America can always be a relatively difficult subject to teach. It's got a lot of dictatorships and disappearances, and soccer kind of allows you a lens to see that where students are able to enjoy the history of it.
What was it like being in Brazil during the World Cup? I mean, obviously you have expectations for what it will be like, but what was it like when you saw it up close?
The first time when I was there, I couldn't believe it. Brazilians get holidays, a day off of work, when Brazil plays. And so the entire city shuts down. And I think one of the biggest things, if someone was running in to try to get bread in order to have people over to their house before 5 minutes before the World Cup started, because the bakery was going to shut down. Everything closes, right? And that's kind of the atmosphere. And everyone's wearing green and yellow, and it's just genuine happiness as long as Brazil wins.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's interesting because when certain sports franchises are expected to win, it's almost more relief when they win as opposed to elation because there's a fear of failure. What's the atmosphere like in Brazil when you're watching and people are kind of going nuts watching the game? Is it expectation to win? Is it joy?
I think there is an expectation to win, but I don't think it's – I think there's also that joy and euphoria every time a goal is scored to an extent that I don't feel in the United States. I mean, in Brazil, people will wear Brazil shirts, not just on Brazilian Independence Day or for the World Cup, but every day. It's really happy to be Brazilian, and so there's this sense of pride, and soccer is a large part of that.
And Pablo is from Mexico originally, so your recent World Cup history has been less than joyful.
It's been pretty dismal. we're optimists. We always seem to think that we'll make it to quarterfinals. And that's been the goal since 1986, the goal has been, will we make it to the fifth game? Will we make it to quarterfinals? So we set the bar a little lower. We're a little more realistic. And we're just very fortunate to be participating this World Cup.
it was shockingly close in qualification. Mexico was actually on the verge of not qualifying.
We owe Graham Susi a huge present of some sort. Panama... gets left out because of this last-second goal that the Americans score. And so it was...
In a match that did not involve Mexico.
That did not involve Mexico. So goal differentials matter, and Graham Souza should have a statue in Mexico City unveiled within the next 2 weeks.
He's the most popular American footballer.
Absolutely.
There. That is for sure. Molly, be honest. What was Pablo... Did you find that if Mexico had not qualified, that your life would have been largely different over the next few months here?
Yes. Pablo's on the record as teaching the course and this upcoming fall, and that decision was made after Mexico qualified. And I remember watching the game, and I sat behind him because I couldn't actually. He was so tense. We watched it in Spanish, and I've never heard "We love you, America" more.
Were they saying that? Is that well?
"We love you, America. We love you, America." When the goal was scored, I've having lived in Mexico for 2 years. It was the most love for America in 2 minutes that I've ever heard.
This is accurate.
We're going to talk much more about Brazilian culture with our professors who are here for the hour. Pablo and Molly from the University of Rochester, not only teaching the class that we're also excited about, history of Latin America through soccer, but also teaching on a number of other subjects, and they both have such impressive backgrounds. I also want to talk to Pat, though, about what our expectations should be for the Americans. You know, Pat, a very interesting thing has developed over the last couple of weeks. Not only did the American coach, who happens to be one of the great footballers of all time, Jürgen Klinsmann, a German, not only did he decide not to take the greatest American soccer player ever, Landon Donovan, but now, interestingly, an interview he gave, I think, in December surfaced in which he was saying there isn't a realistic chance we could win this World Cup. We're not going to win it. We're not ready to do that. And, you know, you have this the American press going, how could the coach be saying that we're not ready to win? What is your take when you hear the coach say that?
Well, I think, again, it's taken out of context because it was done a while back. And I heard about it as though it happened yesterday.
We all did, you know. Klinsmann says they can't win. Turns out it was in December. But he may say the same thing today. I think the point he's making is that as a country, we are not on the level of the Brazils of the world.
Well, a lot has to do with the domestic league that we have in place and where we are as a growth as a country towards achieving that. Can it happen? Certainly it can happen. But he's realistically looking at these other countries and saying they have domestic leagues that have been in place for many, many years, and they've been able to develop a culture and a strength and a system of play that radiates through their national team. And so it's something that they have, like Brazil, for instance. I mean, it's part of their culture. And so the thought of winning that is not realistic. If you're going to Brazil and you're going to play in the World Cup, then you're expecting Brazil to win it.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the U.S. Going there right now, he's trying to build some sort of a culture with us. It's kind of interesting when you look at the Dutch. I mean, it's 5 million people. But if you look at their system of play and what they've put in place at the youth levels, it radiates all the way up to their national team and the way they play. And it's kind of, you know, looking at 5 million people and being able to do that, and then you look at our country and 350 million people, you would think that we would have something like that in place already. But it has a lot to do with the fact that our domestic league is really just starting to grow.
Molly Ball, when a Brazilian child gets the first gift, what is it?
Usually a soccer ball.
Yeah, and that's just not the case in the United States. I mean, and that may never be the case in the United States. But, Pat, interestingly enough, Klinsmann's point is not just about this World Cup. His point is about a systematic overhaul of the quality of preparation of players and of the quality of our domestic leagues, which isn't just MLS, of course. Eventually, that means a higher quality of play across the board. But the Rochester Rhinos, we see that. To me, they look like a much more entertaining product than they were 15 years ago. And 15 years ago, they were pretty entertaining.
I would say that, again, our league has grown. So when you look at the quality of player that's in our league alone, the type of play has changed. I mean, there's more dynamic play that didn't necessarily exist as much back when I was coaching 20 years ago. So I think right now, with that dynamic player and the athletes that are coming along, because of that domestic league being able to provide more money, more funding, more ability to earn more as a player. Now you have more kids that are looking at it and saying, hey, there's a viable opportunity here rather than going to basketball or football or what have you, and American football. But essentially, I think now you're going to find that there's going to be a lot more athletes that are going to take the option of playing soccer. And when you put the athlete with the ability to play and the ability to have the technique that you need to be on the field and exhibit the highest level, then you're going to be able to compete with most of these other countries.
Landon Donovan, it's amazing for me to confront the idea that he's 32 now. I mean, I remember when there was a controversy over whether he would play on the Olympic team as a 20 or a 19-year-old. Well, now he is considered older for soccer. And the strange thing about his relationship with Klinsmann is that last year he took a sabbatical. He kind of gave up soccer for 6 months or so, cleared his head, said he came back refreshed. Klinsmann never really forgave him for that. He said this notion of a superstar, even if you're on the downside of your career, just walking away from your sport for a while and then expecting to come back and be bestowed a position, he never really got over that. And I think that's one of the factors he chose in not taking him to Brazil. Would you have taken Landon Donovan to Brazil?
I think based upon the history and looking at, again, if you're, it's kind of interesting that he would say that we might not have a chance of winning, but essentially by not taking Landon, I view it as him saying, here's my best opportunity.
Yeah, I agree.
So it could have been, he could have easily taken the easy road and said, let me bring Landon. He's an iconic figure for U.S. soccer, and you know, no one's going to criticize me for my action. I think by not taking him, I think he took the approach that, you know, if we're not going to be using him as a starter and we're going to using him in a role situation, what are the downsides to that? And I think the media response, the attention towards Landon, all focuses that would be taken away from the team would make it difficult to win. I think, you know, by doing what he did, now he's putting more focus on the younger players, the players that they want to see excel. You know, when you look at the opportunity of Bradley playing more as a defensive midfielder versus playing more as the man of the team, you have to take into account that, because if you have Landon there, now he's playing more of a defensive role than more of an attacking role. So I think those are the types of things he took into account and realized that it was more beneficial to not bring him aboard.
My 10-year-old nephew's name is Landon, and he was named after Landon Donovan. And there are not a whole lot of American children named after soccer players, but there are a lot of Landons out there. And it's because of moments like this one. I want to play the clip of not only one of the great American soccer goals ever scored. It happened to be against a soccer superpower named Algeria in 2010 at the end of group play in the 91st minute. But what I also love about this moment 4 years ago is Ian Dark gets the call so exquisitely right. And any excuse I have to play this, I'm going to take it. So let's relive the moment when the U.S. thought they were about to be eliminated in group play until Captain America saved them.
Landon Donovan, there are things on here for the USA. Can they do it here? Cross, and Dempsey is denied again, and Donovan has scored! Oh, can you believe this? Go, go, USA! Certainly through. Oh, it's incredible. You could not write a script like this.
And you also could not script a better call. Yeah. How good was that, Pat?
Oh, that was an exciting moment for this country. I mean, it made a lot of fans of people that maybe were on the fence. I mean, you look at the casual fan that only watches the World Cup, for instance, and now you have the fan that watched that and said, okay, what's going on with their domestic league, and now they become fans of the domestic league,
and they might end up at Salem Stadium.
Okay,
I don't think that's an overstatement. I mean, it may not be in the numbers of thousands, but there will be some, won't there?
Well, definitely. And I mean, not necessarily for the Rhinos, but the Western New York Flash have that same sort of mystique, where, you know, maybe for the continuous games and supporting the team throughout the whole season, it isn't always a high attendance. But when you look at that individual game where we had Abby coming back from the Olympics and we had 15,000 people there, so it becomes more of an event situation as well.
What Pat is talking about, that sports moment that's so hard to they're so rare where an entire room of people who might be marginal fans explodes in unison and becomes one. The next clip I want to play is a packed restaurant and bar in Lincoln, Nebraska, of all places, that you might not think is a soccer bastion. This is them watching that moment, and this is the sound of America responding to the Donovan goal. That's the sound of new soccer fans, isn't it, Pat?
That is. And then when you get to Brazil, if they don't win, they throw their TVs out the window.
We're talking World Cup as it kicks off tomorrow in Brazil with Pat Ercole, the team president of the Rochester Rhinos. And Molly Ball is here. Pablo Sierra is here. They are professors at the University of Rochester teaching a class this coming fall called History of Latin America Through Soccer. So just having so much fun talking about not only World Cup football but also Brazilian culture. And Pat, with Donovan not there this year, and he wouldn't have played much even if he'd been on the roster, who's likely to create that kind of a moment this year? Probably Clint Dempsey, but give me a sense for some of the names that the average fan may only be briefly familiar with.
Well, I think, again, you're building a team around Bradley. I think that's what you're going to get. Clint Dempsey, he's always been there for the big moments. He struggled a little bit in Seattle, but Altidore as well over the last game. He hit two goals, and he's starting to show that, you know, and at that level, he's ready. So I think those are the names that you're going to see that are going to, come forth. Tim Howard obviously is going to help us in the back.
Yeah, he will have to.
Yeah, there'll be times you'll be called on, and he's played at a high level, so obviously he's going to be ready for it. I think again that first game against Ghana is key. They need to get a result in that game. They get a result in that game, you build confidence on it. Now you're going to be playing in Portugal and Germany, and you know, you'll go into those games with a different sort of confidence.
Yeah, it's such a fun time as just a citizen of the world because starting tomorrow, one match tomorrow, and then Friday, three matches a day for a while, sometimes four. And so just about any time of the day starting around noon, you can turn on the TV and see World Cup football, and you can see the way the different countries, you know, the different songs and the different chants and the different cultures all coming together. For the United States, our group and the teams are stacked in groups of four. Two of the four from each group advance. It's the United States, Ghana, Portugal, and Germany. And we call that the group of death. Every World Cup has one group that is the one you don't want to be in. So, Pat, that first match against Ghana, who's the weakest in the group, Klinsmann himself has said, have to win it.
Definitely.
And that's Monday.
They've had difficulty against Ghana, but again, it hasn't. I don't believe it's ever been in the opening games. So as you strategically play the other games, you're looking at different formations, trying to get the most out of the group of players that you've brought with you. But being the first game, you know that we're putting our best lineup up against that Ghana. So it's going to be a different game, even if you're looking back and saying Ghana's had the upper hand on us. I don't necessarily think that in this regard because it's going to be the opening game. But they still have quality players and they have the same mentality. It's that opening game. We need to get the points in this game because it's not going to be any easier going against Germany and Portugal.
Apart from Pablo's Mexico, give me the nations that really give me the nations that excite you that the United States isn't playing. I cannot walk away from the television if what nation is playing?
Well, obviously Brazil in that group, Spain and the Netherlands in the next group. You're looking at Uruguay. It's a country that people, I think they're looking at Suarez and saying, okay, is he going to show up to play? And if he does, then He's a handful to take care of.
Forgive me. Is he the one who was on fire in the last World Cup? Was that, if I'm trying to remember, was it Suarez?
It was Forlan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So you've got – okay.
Yeah, he's been on fire at the EPL, though. in England, he's been on fire. So you have Italy in that group, too. That's not an easy group. We have Uruguay, England, and Italy. So England's always had the tough go. But I think I'm impartial to Italy because of my heritage. And then you have, you know, you're looking at Germany, Argentina. Those are teams that, you know, I could see a Brazil-Argentina final that would
wouldn't that
make
be amazing?
It unbelievable.
Wouldn't that be in the South American continent? We're going to talk to Melly and Pablo about that. What would happen in South America if that happened? For me, it's any time Lionel Messi is on the field. I want to be watching. And I talked about my nephew named Landon. My other nephew, who's not named Landon, is they're both very good soccer players. He's even better. And he just idolizes Messi.
Yeah, there's a lot of young 11, 12, 13-year-olds that are in that same situation.
Especially 5'7" kids who think, you know what, you don't have to be a giant on the field to be the best in the world.
No, we have our youth program, and we have a U13 girls team. And there's one girl that... her heritage is from Spain, so Messi's the best player in the world for her, which he is. But, you know, he's always had difficulty. I mean, this is his World Cup, really. So it's going to be interesting to see how he reacts as well. He obviously is a handful. I know he's been coming off some injuries and stuff, so we'll see what he can bring to the table. But certainly if Brazil and Argentina play, you know, I would hope that Brazil wins because I'd hate to see what would happen down there if they don't.
That's just, we're just hoping for world peace. Is what we're Molly, what happens when Brazil loses down there?
Well, I think I was thinking about what you were saying about the sound of the – you played in Lincoln, Nebraska, and there's actually a museum of football in Sao Paulo, which has this amazing visual and audio element to it, and they play the Maracanazo, which is when Uruguay beats Brazil in the World Cup final in 1950 in Rio de Janeiro. And there's all this yelling and then it's complete silence. And I think that there's crying, there's weeping. I'm sure the economic, the productivity and the economy slows down. I mean, I think that there are definite repercussions, not to mention if we got into what potential political repercussions could be. This is a very politically charged moment. Brazil's going to have a presidential election coming up. So what does that mean when people have been protesting stadiums and the amount of money that has gone into this and things, will they or will they not be ready? So I think if Brazil doesn't win, and they were in the final, it could potentially be – well, it would be something everyone would always limit.
Agree with that, Paolo?
I think that's
– is she understating it?
Well, a little bit. I think Brazil making it to the semifinals or the finals would be a commendable effort. They're a very young group of players. They're relatively inexperienced. The problem is what happens if they don't get to that stage. And today the Brazil legend Tostão, who won the 1970 World Cup, published a piece in Brazil's most important newspaper saying, you know, this is a possibility. We can not win the World Cup. There are 31 other teams. And that's,
as in Brazil is sort of assuming it's on our soil, it's our right to the cup.
It's a scary possibility if they don't make it to semis, at the very least.
And especially if Argentina has something to say about it.
Right.
How much is the rivalry between Brazil and Argentina?
Oh, it's fierce.
It's
fierce, yes. And it's been so since forever. certainly since 1970, which is when Brazil really becomes the world power in soccer. And Argentina has struggled to keep up with Brazil's merits since then. It would be catastrophic, but Brazilians do appreciate good soccer, and they appreciate Messi.
I was about to say that you see Messi jerseys in Brazil,
How could you not appreciate his skill, even if he's playing for the wrong country, if you're a Brazilian?
I think that most Brazilians do appreciate Messi, and I think the fact that you see kids, adults wearing Messi jerseys, they're not going to have a Maradona jersey on, but they will. They will have Messi, and that speaks a lot when. What team jerseys you buy, that's a topic of conversation before World Cup. Am I going to get Portugal's? Am I going to get Brazil's, right?
Well, let's take the shortest break in radio, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about the FIFA component of this and what's actually going on in Brazilian cities. There's been a lot of controversy over the money being spent, who benefits, who doesn't, FIFA's rules and sort of the way that they kind of run the show when they come into a World Cup setting. So I know that our professors will have plenty to say about that. And, Pat, I'm not a big fan of sports predictions. I don't think there's any use to them. But do you have an expectation that the United States will come out of group play? Or not? The odds say no.
I would say that I'm pretty confident that they'll get through the group. It's going to be difficult, though. Like I said, it hinges on this first game.
I'm going to talk to you Tuesday, and if they've beaten Ghana, you're going to be saying, see? And if they have not beaten Ghana, you're going to say, I'd like to expunge that comment from the record there.
I'm a dual citizen, so.
Pat Ercoli has been joining us from the Rochester Rhinos. Thanks for your soccer analysis, by the way, Pat.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We could talk all day on this. Short break, and then we'll get into the culture side of the World Cup as we talk about that on member-supported public radio. Coming up next hour, following the money on American education policy, does it bother you that Bill Gates is now the most powerful person in U.S. teaching policy? We'll look at the financial connections that the Gates Foundation has created as we follow breaking news as well. The Gates Foundation announcing just a few hours ago that they would like to see the Common Core delayed for 2 years to give teachers more time to get ready. That's next hour on Connections.
Opening this week at the Little Theater, from acclaimed director Pavel Pawlikowski comes Ida, a moving and intimate drama about a young nun in 1960s Poland who, on the verge of taking her vows, makes a shocking discovery about her past. In this film, Pawlikowski returns to his native Poland for the first time in his career to confront some of the more contentious issues in the history of his birthplace. Powerfully written and eloquently shot, Ida is one of the best foreign language films we've shown this year. See details at thelittle.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and having so much fun on this Wednesday as we are on the eve of the World Cup kickoff in Brazil, talking Brazilian culture with two University of Rochester professors, a husband and wife team teaching a class this fall called History of Latin America Through Soccer. Pablo Sierra is an assistant professor of history at the U of R. Molly Ball is an adjunct professor of history who is an expert on modern Brazil and an economic historian to boot. And Pablo is from Mexico originally. Molly is from the United States. But we are all keen on watching what's going on there. We're also keen on understanding how this is impacting the country. And this past week, on Sunday, John Oliver, formerly of The Daily Show, now the host of, I think his new show is called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver on HBO, very similar format to The Daily Show, he tackled the issue of FIFA. And he talked about this organization that runs the World Cup that has become a big, big moneymaker, even though they are a nonprofit technically. And he spent 13 minutes breaking down the way FIFA is kind of a cabal that runs this thing. And here is a clip of what John Oliver was talking about.
Now FIFA says they leave a lot behind, which they do, like new laws. Because, you see, once upon a time, Brazil did this.
In 2003, the Brazilian government banned alcohol from stadiums because of the enormously high death rate amongst fans.
Well, that seems like a good idea. Potentially life-saving, even. The only problem is Budweiser is one of FIFA's key sponsors, and they sell a product they reflexively insist on calling beer. And FIFA seemed anxious to protect Budweiser from a law designed to protect people, which is why FIFA's Secretary General went to Brazil with a simple message.
I'm sorry to say, and maybe I look a bit arrogant, but that's something we'll not negotiate. I mean, there will be, and there must be, as part of the law, the fact that we have the right to sell beer.
And the amazing thing is here, FIFA won. They successfully pressured Brazil into passing a so-called Budweiser bill, allowing beer sales in soccer stadiums. And at this point, you can either be horrified by that or relieved that FIFA wasn't also sponsored by cocaine and chainsaws.
So there's a clip. First of all, on the accuracy of the law. Molly, you were nodding right away, the beer law.
I think that was one of the things when I went to my first soccer game in Brazil, because you go to the States for an American football game and you go, people go get a beer. And there was no beer for sale. and that was just taken. Things are already rowdy enough as it is. There is plenty, I think, of beer drinking ahead of time. And so it's just not an aspect that you find in the stadiums.
And now, with FIFA's law, you know, you both were reacting to that segment there, laughing a bit, but there's always truth and great humor, Pablo. And what do you make of FIFA's actions there?
Well, it's unfortunate because it really is an imposition, a cultural imposition, if you will. Brazilians have struggled with violence at soccer stadiums. That's a fact. That's true in most parts of the world. They took a very hard choice in banning beer sales for the right reason. And the fact that this really transnational organization can come in and modify a constitutional decree is frightening, is unfortunate. And I do think many, many Brazilians resented that that action by Sepp Blatter and FIFA.
We were also speaking before the hour began about where the American matches will be played. One of the matches will be played in a city called Manaus, and Manaus is a city that didn't have a humongous stadium before because they don't have a large club team there, but they built, by the records I've seen, a $270 million stadium, and there will be a total of four World Cup matches, not four United States matches, four matches total played there in this humongous stadium, and that's it. And then the World Cup is out of there, and they're left with this monstrous stadium on the bend of a river that doesn't seem to have much purpose. Molly, I know you've spoken to people from there. What's the reaction there?
Well, I think some people are excited, but I think in general people just think it's a huge waste of money and time and resources. I think historically building things in Manaus is difficult. One of the problems they had was with the seats melting. Because the sun was so hot, they had to completely get a different set of seats. And because the materials you have to use are different, they couldn't build a railroad in the late 19th century because you couldn't use the type of wood that everybody was using to build railroads. So there's not a railroad to get from Bolivia to the coast, right? So this is a problem that the city, it originally comes about as part of the rubber boom. So it's this, it's kind of been decadence almost since the 1920s, and so this is kind of another. There's another Manaus opera house. There's a famous opera house there that was built in the early 20th century, and that's kind of what it seems it's going
to
be.
And to some degree, there's this idea that when Brazil was awarded the World Cup in 2003, that it was a nationwide celebration because the country loves its soccer and it's going to host this event. But when you see these things happening, Pablo, I guess not everybody is celebrating now.
No. When Brazil is awarded the FIFA World Cup, it is euphoria in the streets because there's euphoria in Brazil. The economy is booming. You have the Workers' Party with a president that people identify with who's very charismatic. And the project was sold on a high. And now we're on a low. Now we have with a president that's less than charismatic, with an economy that's slowing down. And now it's become very unpopular since last June, actually. And the consequences of this are pretty severe. The idea was that Brazil was going to use the World Cup as a catalyst to develop infrastructure. About 50% of those infrastructure projects that were begun have not been finished, will not be finished, to put more precisely. And that is causing a great deal of resentment, and I think justifiably so. The government has not delivered on the promise that this World Cup was going to be more than soccer.
Let's talk a little bit about the Brazilian economy. You say that it at the time, 2003, was booming and now slowing down a bit. What's the core of the Brazilian economy?
The chief exports are iron ores and sugar and soybeans and I think maybe oil. So there's still kind of a primary resource when in their chief exports. And that is kind of what they've been able to develop. Petrobras has this program, Brisal, to try to dig deeper to get more oil. And that's always been Brazil's strength, and there have been transformations as to what they get into. They have great airplanes. I'm not sure anybody would think about that in Embraer. Hmm. But in general, they're primary resources.
And what about the leadership in politics? You hinted at that, Pablo?
Yeah. Yes, President Dilma Rousseff, people colloquially call Dilma, is facing a possible re-election in October at a very bad time. She has not been very popular since last summer, actually, since before the Confederations Cup, specifically in the southern region of the country, specifically in Sao Paulo, which is where tomorrow's inauguration will take place, where she will make a brief appearance, attempt not to speak, because she is actually quite disliked in Sao Paulo. So the consequences of this sporting event do have considerable consequences for Dilma. With the economy slowing down, the opposition is gaining force, and they're using all these construction delays, all these corruption scandals as a ticket back into power. And so Dilma has a lot riding on this World Cup, specifically in the south of the country.
So the goal is to make sure that the event goes smoothly and we don't see any more breakdowns?
I think so. I think that we talked about Manaus. Pablo's mentioning the south or the southeast. I think something that honestly gets brushed over a lot is Brazil is a very diverse country. You have the northeast, which is extremely poor, the southeast, which is actually pretty well off. Brazil has one of the highest levels of inequality, developed countries, but a lot of that is regional inequality. And so a lot of the discontent right now, this week has centered in the southeast, which is the most prosperous region, right? And you might have different reactions in different parts of the country and what different programs mean.
And so now, we just came off the Winter Olympics in which Vladimir Putin was everywhere. You're indicating that the Brazilian leader is not going to be everywhere, even though with Vladimir Putin there were delays and there were problems of things not being done. He seemed to steamroll right over that.
I don't know. I feel that speaks to how competitive Brazilian politics have become. And in a sense, it's a measure of how much democracy has advanced in Brazil.
It may be a good sign because in Russia, they don't quite have that.
I was going to say, I think most politicians are going to try to not just Dilma, there's also governing elections. I mean, what's going on in Sao Paulo, people are associating it with Dilma, but actually it's at the state level this is happening, not at the federal level. So I think that most politicians are going to try to stay out of the limelight and hope that Brazil gets as far as possible and that people forget a little bit about the infrastructure and strikes.
Unfortunately, the timing of some of these protests are terrible. Brazil's Sao Paulo's main stadium, which they also spent a great amount of money on, depends on tourists getting to the stadium via the metro. And so you have a huge strike today. Well, this entire week, the last 7 days, by Sao Paulo's metro workers. So there's also a degree of opportunism. How do you negotiate a strike where you need 70,000 people to get from point A to point B? Did they have to strike this week? No. But it is convenient. It will push their agenda forward. And we hope it doesn't inconvenience most of the people who are just there to watch a soccer game. But it very might well.
I've lived through the strikes on the metro and what that means. And Sao Paulo, topographically, is kind of like San Francisco. It's not an easy city to walk from A to B. The metro actually isn't even that well developed. Most people travel in buses, and it has way worse traffic than Los Angeles, sometimes worse than Mexico City, right? So stopping the metro is huge and has meant people can't get to work, people can't get to school. And so I think it has dramatic repercussions.
We played a clip from John Oliver's show in which he kind of went after FIFA. Well, he spent 13 minutes going after FIFA, and it's not difficult to find if you haven't seen it yet. Worth Googling the piece, because if you don't know much about FIFA, they really deserve the criticism they're getting. Look at the fact that the 2022 World Cup has been selected to be in Qatar, which during the time of the matches, regularly sees temperatures around 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So you talk about Manaus and seats melting in the sun. That may be nothing compared to the people melting, all because the rumors are tens of billions of dollars tossed around privately. We'll see if that gets shelved. But having said that, in the John Oliver piece, Molly and Pablo were saying there was a couple things he got a little bit wrong. And Molly, you mentioned the number of cities or FIFA forcing stadiums being built to Pablo. What did he miss there?
So technically, FIFA says you need to have X number of stadiums ready with a capacity of 50 to 60,000 fans at the least. Unfortunately, there was no need to build 12 or to have 12 host cities. That was a decision made by the Brazilian government, almost a clientelistic approach, a way of spreading the wealth. Right. A normal World Cup has 8 cities, maybe 9 cities hosting this tournament. There is no reason to build a stadium in Amazonia, right? There's no reason to have a stadium in regions that aren't really football crazed. And that's, I think, something that's important to note here. There are parts of Brazil that are not necessarily connected to this soccer fervor. And Manaus is one of those. So, yes, FIFA is partly responsible for this. A lot of this also has to fall on the Brazilian government and on these contracts that were awarded and renegotiated incessantly.
I think a sense of the government having this idea of, you said, spreading the wealth or the diversity there is. Brazil moves its capital city from Rio de Janeiro to Brasilia, creates a city in 1960, which I think most people would tell you wasn't a good idea if you look at it economically, just so it could be centrally located. The majority of Brazil's population since the colonial period has been coastal, right? And so anything that is deep into the Amazon or, I don't know, Mato Grosso, they have to spend a lot more money to get the infrastructure developed there, and there isn't the fan base there. There aren't the populations living there that may necessarily merit that.
Interestingly enough, we've just scratched the surface on South American soccer through one country, but coming up in the fall, our guests, my guests for the hour, Molly and Pablo, are teaching at the University of Rochester history of Latin America through soccer, and obviously Brazilian culture, a huge part of that. But you touched a little bit, Molly, on the fact that that there is passion and that bad results can be taken with a serious darkness. And I remember in the 1994, the Colombian own goal. The story in 1994, the United States was playing Colombia in, I think, group play, and an own goal in soccer is when a defensive player accidentally kicks the ball into their own net, and that's what happened to Colombia on a play that could have happened to any defender. It just happens in a moment. And that defender, well, let me ask our guest to tell the story.
I actually was talking to Pablo about this, and I told him he can't appreciate it because he comes from Mexico and he's filled out all of his World Cup albums and this is a part of who he is. But my family didn't grow up watching soccer. And I was all of, I think, 10 or 11 years old when this happened. And I remember when Andres Escobar, who scored the own goal, was killed subsequently in Colombia.
He was murdered.
He was murdered. It was all tied into the drug war and narcotraficantes. And I'm not sure if I understood all of that, but for the first time, I understood that soccer was more important for many people around the world than watching SEC football was for my family.
Right.
Or baseball. This is a different level.
And Molly, not to make light of it, but you probably grew up thinking your family was crazy about the SEC football.
They are crazy about that. Okay. My uncle had a Gamecock in Miami.
But right? There is no risk of an SEC player, if you give up, if you're a cornerback who gives up the game-winning touchdown, there's no risk that you're going to be murdered.
No, I don't think if Peyton Manning...
He had a terrible Super Bowl. But he's still beloved.
He's still alive and beloved. And it was this moment that I remembered way before I went to Brazil, way before I got into soccer, that marked me. And I honestly think that it marked many people in the United States. They lost to the United States, right? And we just watched the movie, The Two Escobars, last night on it.
On ESPN, the 30 for 30 film, absolutely worth watching and looking up. Beautifully done, but dark and shocking. And I hope, Pablo, that story is an outlier, but I'm scared to think that, not that players are getting killed all over the place, but that kind of passion is something that, as Molly so accurately says, it's hard for us to grasp it.
It is very hard to grasp. Soccer is something you grow up with in Latin America, in soccer-playing nations. It's a rite of passage that before each World Cup, you fill out your Panini soccer album. This is requisite for childhood in Latin America. You trade these 600 or so stickers, you fill your team pages, and it's part of the buildup to the World Cup. That still hasn't caught on here. It's coming. I can sense the change. I see it. However, you structure your childhood around World Cups, and you tend to think of, what was I doing in 1994 when the Cup was in the States? What was I doing in 1990 Italy? And many of us do very much remember our life, or at least our summers, through World Cups, right? So when you have that kind of structure, it's a cultural structure in your head, it kind of gives you a sense of how important soccer is to the region as a whole.
Let's talk about some of the positive aspects of this, because I remember in 98, I was working, a good friend of mine is a Parisian, and I was with her when Zinedine Zidane was filling up the net for France. And just the reaction, again, as an American, watching the reaction was unlike anything I'd ever seen. Even me growing up in Cleveland, a crazed sports town that knows losing more than anybody else, I still had never encountered that. But it was so neat because I felt all of a sudden I felt like I was interested to learn more about different cultures. You know, different cultures, different countries will come in with different traditions, et cetera. And I think there is a great opportunity. We focused on some of the negative, but I think there's an opportunity for this to be kind of like the Olympics in a way that helps the world think about each other and even outside of the pitch. Am I being overly romantic, Molly?
No, I don't think you are. And I think Brazil is a great place to do that. Brazil is a very diverse, not only geographically, but also culturally. They have a huge influx of Italians, Germans, Japanese, Portuguese, right? It's a multicultural society, and they are really open to having people come in, and they love people coming to visit Brazil. You feel that, right? So I think that is going to foster that environment that you're talking about. And I think it'll be a really good experience for everyone.
No, it is true that soccer, global soccer, especially every 4 years, becomes this common language. I remember being a junior in college and spending a semester abroad in Senegal, in West Africa, and I would take my Mexico jersey, and I'd be walking through this traditional marketplace, and the fish vendors would come up to me, and they'd say, Blanco, that's a Blanco jersey. And I'd say, yeah, it is. And they'd say, you know, I still remember his goal in 1998. And it's the kind of conversation you don't expect to have in a Senegalese fish marketplace. But people do know these names, and they do know these figures, and they remember the results and the interactions. Last World Cup in Mexico, when Ghana loses by not scoring that penalty kick, there was a profound sense of empathy throughout, I'd say, the country, because, man, we wanted Ghana to go through. And that's something incredible, that we can unite, despite our ideological differences, despite our political differences, a simple soccer match can really put us into contact with one another. I think that's some of the magic of the World Cup, and we'll see some of that this summer.
A German friend of mine made German potato salad and brought German beer on when we had a chance to watch the U.S. and then Germany back-to-back. That's some of the joy of doing that. So there are these great traditions. We've got a few minutes left with Pablo Sierra and Molly Ball, University of Rochester professors and experts in culture, economics, and history in South America. I'd like you each to tell us a little bit about what, some of the things we haven't talked about that the course, your course in the fall, History of Latin America Through Soccer, will cover. I'll start with Molly.
I think one of the, almost talking back to the last question, the idea of why this is going to be culturally diverse and kind of a world event, it's also a showcase for Latin America, and that Latin America has changed a lot since the 1970s, 1980s, and it's really the first mega event that's taking place to show after hyperinflation, after military dictatorships. And so the idea behind the course was to look at how soccer isn't an island, to take the line from the two Escobar, soccer isn't an island. All of these things were going on. But the idea of the course was to use soccer as a tool to understand the cultural development, economic development, politics in the 20th century Latin America.
Pablo?
Yeah, and something I've been fascinating about is how or why does soccer develop the way it develops in Latin America? It's an English sport. It's not native to Latin America. And so there's this fascinating period in the early 20th century where you have soccer clubs emerging out of cricket clubs and polo clubs. And it's a very elite sport. I mean, people show up in suits and tuxedos to watch this, and how it becomes a popular sport, becomes an immigrant sport. It becomes a sport associated with factory teams. And that's especially true in Uruguay, Argentina, and Brazil. And that's an aspect that's fascinating that I think is understudied. And we will certainly cover that in the course.
And I guess just really quick, on a national level, I think it's really the 1930s and 1940s when a lot of Latin American countries are looking for their identity and what it means to be Mexican, Argentinian, Brazilian, that there's really this emphasis on promoting soccer by the government. And that's when you see this cultural element that becomes the part where your first president is a soccer ball, or everybody is going to watch the games and everything's going to shut down.
Got about a minute left here. In South Africa, unfortunately, I remember the Vuvuzelas. Is there anything that we will not be used to that we will notice in Brazil watching these matches, or anything that should stand out to us?
I think I think you'll hear a lot more drums and see a lot more samba.
Drums and samba.
I think you'll enjoy that.
Yeah, over the vuvuzelas, and absolutely.
I think overall this will be a showcase opportunity for the South American teams. I think Colombia, Ecuador, we don't think of them as powerhouses. They will be powerhouses. They are on their continent, and I think the noise, the chants from the South American fans will be deafening, and it will be fantastic.
Fortunate for the Americans, even though they're in the group of death, not to be facing a South American team in the first group.
Yes.
That may make it seem like a road match for both sides, as opposed to, boy, is it hard to win on the road, no matter where
yes.
you are, you know, so as we see. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And by the way, Pablo, and to you, Molly, I hope Mexico plays well, because you have to tolerate Pablo, and I've been there. I know. I get it. So good luck to Mexico, and we'll talk to you again. Thanks for sharing your expertise with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great fun. We appreciate that discussion. Short break, and coming back, we're covering breaking news today on Connections. Don't undersell the importance of the Gates Foundation's announcement today that they would like to see the Common Core shelved for 2 years. We're going to follow the money with Common Core next.